This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Book of Essie by Megan McLean Weir. Read for you by Tara Sands, Aaron Spencer, and Robbie Damond. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen. Esther chapter 2, verse 17. Then Esther the queen answered and said, If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. Esther chapter 7, verses 3 through 4. Esther. On the day I turn 17, there is a meeting to decide whether I should have the baby, or if sneaking me to a clinic for an abortion is worth the PR risk. I am not invited, which is just as well, since my being there might imply that I have some choice in the matter, and I know that I have none. I listen in, though, the way Lyssa and I used to before she went away. It was Lyssa who discovered the vent in the wall of the laundry room, who realized that you could eavesdrop on everything that was said in the production office if you climbed onto the dryer and put your ear up against the filigreed bronze gate. The winter Lyssa broke her leg, she was 14 and I was 9. I remember she chose an orange cast that Mother hated, and the doctor laughed and said something about Lyssa being a firecracker, and Mother frowned but didn't dare to disagree, not with the cameras rolling. I could tell she was worried that the color was too bright, that it would bleed on screen or at the very least be distracting. It lasted only a second, the withering look she shot my sister as the fiberglass was unwrapped and wound round and round the crack above Lyssa's ankle. But even at 9, I was well-versed in Mother's methods of wordless communication. I knew exactly what to look for. Just as I knew to look for the flash of defiance in Lyssa's eyes that was my sister's only reply. The doctor signed the cast when he was done, and so did all the nurses. Then Lyssa and I were given popsicles for the ride home. They were orange, to match the cast, but Mother made us throw them in the trash as soon as we reached the parking lot. She said the sugar would ruin our teeth, but I think she really did it just to punish us. To remind Lyssa that she shouldn't count on the cameras for protection, that they might delay the consequences of her actions but would never entirely prevent them. She needn't have bothered. It was the first lesson any of us learned. That cast was the reason it became my job to climb up and report everything the grown-up said, because Lyssa couldn't do it herself without breaking the only good leg she had left. It's possible that without that orange cast, Lyssa would never have told me about the vent at all, since trusting me was a risk. She might have kept the secret to herself, ferreting away this little piece of knowledge the way she used to hide the chocolate bars she stole from Stahl's sweet shop when she stopped in with Becca Twomey on their way home from school. Lyssa never bought anything, but Becca was allowed to spend her allowance on whatever she wanted. In any case, that was how it seemed. Lyssa and I, on the other hand, were allowed chocolate only on birthdays and Easter. I always wondered, after she was gone and I found the box of unopened candy under her bed, why she bothered to steal it at all? Why she took such a chance? If she had been found out, it wouldn't have been only Daddy's paddle she'd have had to contend with. Mother's silent punishment would have been much worse. It meant something, I realized, that Lyssa could sneak the Milky Ways into her bag without Mr. Stahl noticing, yet never bring herself to open them. Eating the chocolate, I saw much later on, would have been the thing that made the stealing real. The dryer is running and slightly warm when I sit on it. It's a pleasant sensation, but the clang of some sort of metal clip getting thwapped against the drum covers up the sound of the producer speaking on the other side of the wall. So I turn the dryer off. Once the drum has stopped turning, I can hear well enough to make out what Candy is saying. The name fits her. Sweet as sugar, but hard enough to break a tooth on. She has been with us since before I was born. Since that first Christmas special when Maddie was not quite three, and my parents had just been told that there would be no more children. Daddy had spent so much time on television by then, you'd have thought it would have come naturally. But Mother said he was as nervous as a pig in a bacon factory the day the new crew started filming. Up until then, the cameras had only been at church, where they were entirely under Daddy's control. Could he tell them that the balance of power was subtly shifting? In any case, Mother had to force Daddy to let the crew into the house, and even then, he did this thing where he scratched his wrist incessantly any time the cameras were pointed at him. Candy's team did their best to edit this out, to use the close-ups of his pensive expression and his clear blue eyes. But there are a few shots where you can see him moving his fingers back and forth compulsively, as if possessed, like an addict scratching at invisible bugs burrowing just beneath his skin. Mother stole the show, though, so it didn't matter. She cried real tears when she revealed their struggles to conceive, their disappointment. She was candid when she confessed that they had always wanted a big family, a brood, a flock to tend and raise up in his grace and light. After all, if children are a gift from God, surely Daddy was deserving of more than just a single blessing, since he had made it his life's work to speak his truth and praise his name even in these darkest days. She sighed and reached out and took my father's hand then, stilled it, and held it tight to keep him from scratching. With her eyes turned up to the ceiling, the tears welled at first, but did not fall. Then Mother looked directly at the camera and breathed something about accepting God's will, and those fat drops rolled right down her tastefully rouged cheeks, as if she had control over gravity itself. That hour-long special probably would have just been a one-off since Daddy said the focus should be on his ministry, not on his family. But on Christmas Eve, they found out that Daniel was on the way, and people called it an honest-to-God miracle, and there was no stopping after that. 9 months later, when my brother was born, 10 million people tuned in to see it happen. Not the actual moment, of course, but everything leading up to it. The praying, the hand-holding, the reciting of bits of verse. Then he was lifted, slick and shrieking and still streaked with blood, and Daddy let loose a heartfelt alleluia, and a regular television phenomenon was born. On the other side of the wall, I hear Candy say, "Are you sure?" To her credit, there is no judgment in her tone. None that I can detect in any case. Her face might be an entirely different matter, but I cannot see it. I can imagine, though, the near-silent signs of disapproval. The slightly downturned lip. The light tap of a perfectly manicured nail on the polished wood surface of the table. Candy has no children, after all. We are all the family she's got. It's possible that this feels personal, though I doubt she would ever admit it. I watched her repeat the test myself. This is my mother's voice, smooth and velvety and utterly composed. You would think she was discussing which muffin recipe she might bake for an upcoming church fair, parsing the relative merits of currants and pumpkin spice. She almost sounds bored. The words fall evenly from her lips, with a hint of a drawl that I recognize as an affectation. Like her modest light blue suit and single strand of pearls, this voice is something that has been carefully chosen, cultivated even. The vocal coach comes once a week on Tuesday mornings and stops by on an as-needed basis to deliver special lozenges if Mother's throat is sore, which is more often than you would expect. She is forever sipping tea with honey and telling people how exhausting it is, running the household all by herself since Daddy has to conserve his energies for more elevated pursuits. Except she doesn't really run the household. Candy does. But no one would ever dare tell Mother that. In the early days, when it was just Daddy's church services that were being broadcast, and before Mother herself was properly a star, they used a voice double for close-ups of Mother standing in the front row during hymns. As the voices of the congregation swelled behind her, Mother would hold her hymnal open at her waist, never looking down at the page, but instead keeping her eyes glued to the stained glass window above and behind the altar. She had each and every song in that book memorized, knew even the page numbers by heart. The organist would play a few bars of introduction, and then Mother's mouth would open and shut in rhythm with the music. Soundlessly, I knew, but it looked for all the world like she was really singing, as if the music itself had her in its thrall. Then the camera would zoom in even closer, and in the version that TIL would broadcast, one voice would be heard rising above the others, a voice like an angel's, or so Daddy liked to tell his parishioners during coffee hour. This sort of compliment always made Mother blush demurely and shake her head so that the gaggle of old women who followed Daddy around at events like this would transition directly from talking about Mother's voice to remarking upon how modest she was. No one knew that the voice was not really hers, that it belonged to a music teacher in Cincinnati named Tracy Goldberg. No one knew that Tracy, raising three children all on her own after her husband skipped town with a waitress from Des Moines, had not even read the non-disclosure agreement Candy had handed her, had not stopped to think what sort of lies she would be helping to perpetuate, since signing that single piece of paper meant that she would never again have to worry about how to feed her children. These days, they still dub in Tracy's voice for the singing, but even the speaking voice that Mother uses now, a voice that she probably thinks of as entirely her own, is a complete work of fiction. This used to make me angry, especially when she was yelling. I used to yell back to try to push her into revealing her true self, that sharp twinge of Appalachia, the dropped consonants, the seemingly arbitrary vowels, but she never did. Eventually, I began to suspect that maybe she had no true self remaining, that it was not just covered up, but had been destroyed entirely. "You watched her?" Candy asks, and here there is a hint of amusement. I know she is picturing me on the toilet, skirt hiked up and underwear around my ankles, holding the stick with just the tips of my fingers as I try to pee on it without getting any on myself. As if such a feat were even possible. "I watched her." In truth, Mother had turned away once I began to shimmy down my cotton briefs. She hasn't seen my bum since I was potty trained, I don't think. And just the idea of that much flesh probably embarrassed her. But she heard the stream of urine, heard me place the stick on the edge of the sink beside her, watched as it turned blue. A mother's worst fear, or so some people say. But not my mother's.
"And she told you she was afraid she might be pregnant?" Candy asks.
How would that conversation have played out? I wonder, and once again I consider it. First off, I would have had to catch Mother alone, with no risk of interruption. No easy task, given the number of people who walk freely through her house. Then I would have had to make sure she was listening, truly listening, and not just nodding her head and gazing vaguely in my direction the way she often does. No. A conversation would have been too risky. There was too great a chance it would have gone according to her plan instead of according to mine. So I bought the pregnancy test and left it in my bathroom where I knew she would find it. Actually, I bought three, though I left the money on the shelf rather than going to the register. The first, I used to confirm what I already knew. The second, I left for her to find. The third, I hid underneath my mattress in case denial kicked in and she threw the second away. No, I found a pregnancy test in her bathroom where she had stashed it, and I knew right then that something must be wrong. From my perch on the dryer, I almost laughed out loud. I find the notion that Mother does not realize that I know she goes through my bathroom drawers almost tragically comical. But more than that, this proposition that she possesses some heightened intuition, that she picked up on some subtle clue and swooped in just in time to play the hero, is blatantly absurd. The pieces to this puzzle should have been apparent to her all along. And the father? Candy is asking. Here, mother is silent. There is the sound of papers being shuffled. Has she really brought notes to this meeting? She couldn't have. She wouldn't want there to be anything in writing, anything that might be tracked. The papers must be for something else. Or maybe they are even blank, just there for effect. Maybe she is playing a part even within that room, just as she does outside it. Finally, Mother answers Candy's question without really answering it at all. We don't have to worry about him. He won't say a word. Of course he won't, I think. He has the most to lose. Well then, says Candy, who has lasted as long as she has by learning when to stop, when not to push. She can tell that this is information that Mother does not plan to share. Let's run through our list of options. Gretchen? At this, I sit up straighter and turn my head so that my ear is pointed up toward the grate. I am curious to see if there are any options, besides the ones of which I am already aware. I hear Gretchen clear her throat. She is younger than Candy and Mother, who are roughly the same age. Brown hair, sharp features, mousy, though that descriptor applies more to a tendency to twitch and scurry rather than to her actual appearance. Her face, taken by itself, is actually rather pretty. Gretchen works in media relations or publicity or whatever it is you call it when your job is to make a fairly unremarkable family universally recognized and adored. At this, she and the others who came before her have been surprisingly successful. Recently, I've tried to dissect this improbability, but when I was growing up, I never really wondered why the show became so popular. Contrary to what some left-wing bloggers might say, this wasn't because I am at all conceited. It was because I lacked perspective. Mother said we were called, with a capital C, to lead by example, and the capital C hung in the air like something holy. So I believed her. I didn't know any better. Other families had enjoyed their 15 minutes of fame, their moment in the spotlight, only to have their shows canceled after a few seasons when the parents divorced or the child who was adorable at age 4 became positively homely at 7 or failed to outgrow a lisp. Or maybe, for no discernible reason at all, the audience simply grew bored and advertising revenue dried up. Then the camera crews would pack up their things and retreat, leaving the house feeling empty, the living room just slightly too large, the rooms eerily quiet. Or so I always assumed. I took it for granted, I guess, that we were special. We were chosen. Or at the very least, odd enough to be intriguing to those who continued to tune in season after season, year after year. Because they did tune in. They watched Daniel take his first steps, saw Maddie cut his knee when he fell off his bike, and cried along with him when he got stitches. They saw Daddy and Mother move to the new house, the one the church built for us, the week before Jacob was due. They marveled at Mother's cool exterior, the calm she exuded in the eye of the storm created by those whirling dervishes who were her many sons. For by then she was vastly outnumbered. Daddy, Maddie, Daniel, and Jacob had been joined by Caleb. Then came Elizabeth, the girl my parents and the nation as a whole had been waiting for. Then triplets, two more girls and a boy, who were born much too early and whose short existence was chronicled and broadcast live from the private room and the neonatal intensive care unit, where their three isolates stood under constant guard. Looking weary but dogged, Mother would lift the thick quilted coverings that encased these strange plastic pods to reveal the closed eyes or purple waxy toes of Mary or Ruth or Zechariah, each of them with tubes disappearing into their mouths and plunged into their belly buttons, dependent upon the machines that pushed air into their tiny underdeveloped lungs or dripped sugar and fat into their blood. Those weeks, the show got the best ratings it ever had. though some said the exploitation of such sick, helpless infants went too far, crossed some invisible line drawn in the sand. Mother was not one to apologize, however, and though people started petitions and vowed to boycott the funeral episode, no one actually did. That month, a photograph of those three miniature caskets lined up side by side in a sea of roses made it onto the cover of Time. There was a break, then, from the making of more babies. It was just as well. After the triplets, the fans had lost their stomach for such things. Apart from a few miscarriages, after each of which the doctors again said that Mother would never be able to bear another child, the show shifted its focus to Maddie and Daniel, then 10 and 8, who begged Mother to let them go to the public school rather than be taught at home. They asked for and received a puppy, a golden retriever named Blister, who shed on the carpet but redeemed himself by learning to catch a frisbee and retrieve a ball. These were some of the most boring episodes, but there was a war on at the time, one of those unnamed conflicts in the Middle East, so the mundanity of it all was probably soothing. Anyway, this sort of thing carried them through until Lissa was nearly 6 and I was born, wholly unexpectedly. Another miracle of a sort, a reward for those fans who had stayed loyal for so long. It was not only the folks who watched Daddy's sermons from the comfort of their couches, or the locals who called out, "Pastor Hicks!" and waved every time he walked down Main Street, who were tuning in. It was not only those who flocked to his church by the thousands who let the episodes fill up their DVRs. Others as well, some devout and others less so, watched with morbid fascination the seeming contradiction that we epitomized. Our family rejected materialism and popular culture, and yet we also produced it. The show, which by then had been called many things, but was currently airing with the title 6 for Hicks, paid for the SUVs Mother and Daddy drove, the lake house, the spiritual retreat that was actually a villa in St. John. It paid for the car seat I rode home in from the hospital, the muslin blankets I was swaddled in when I slept. It paid for my first backpack when it came time for me to go to school, Mother having by then completely abandoned giving lessons in the living room. Not just because her time and energy were better spent promoting our brand, but also because marketing said that what our audience wanted at that point was a character who was normal. The show paid for everything. And now it would pay for a solution to my problem, one chosen from a list that Gretchen, on the other side of the wall that I am leaning up against, is about to run through aloud. She starts with the obvious, though I can tell that it makes her uncomfortable. Just forming the word with her lips in all likelihood feels sinful, and she probably just wants to get it out of the way. "Well, there's an abortion, of course. She'd have to cross state lines to reach a provider, and such a trip would certainly not go unnoticed. An impromptu college visit to New York or Boston might work, or maybe even something abroad, though safety might then be an issue. The trip to Cuba is already on the books. A contact of mine knows a doctor there who will work for cash and promise discretion." "I'll consider it," Mother says, and I feel the air go out of my lungs. My skull begins to buzz. She makes this statement as if it is nothing to her. A choice of deli meats at the supermarket counter. Thinly sliced roast beef or ham. She speaks as if she has not spent the last 20 years railing publicly against abortion and organizing protest marches on the front lawn of the only Democratic official within 100 miles, even though as controller he has nothing to do with health services of any kind. An abortion is not anything I have ever wanted. But then again, I never wanted any of this. And for the first time, I consider how it could erase what has happened, and maybe even turn back time. As I feel the last of the heat leave the dryer beneath me, I allow myself to hope that there is some part of my mother that cares about my future above her own. That I will at least be offered the choice. But Gretchen is already talking again, and I know that despite what Mother says, she will not really consider it. Not because she is so staunchly pro-life, a position that I now realize is just another carefully crafted aspect of her public persona, but because her empire would come crashing down if we were ever caught. That sort of crash almost occurred when Lissa left and refused to have the cameras follow her. All season they had aired tape of Lissa looking at colleges, but when she left for Northwestern just shy of her 18th birthday, she made it clear that she was going there alone. There were a few unflattering articles written, but Mother found a way to squelch the rumors that Lissa was a girl gone wild, and after those last shots of Mother and Daddy carrying boxes into her freshman dorm, Lissa was never seen on film again. Every once in a while, a grainy photo will show up in some tabloid rag, but for the most part, she has proved remarkably adept at avoiding the paparazzi. That, or they have taken pity on her, which I suppose is entirely possible. Back when the triplets died, people used to cry that those babies were never asked if they wanted to be on television. They said it was a travesty. But none of us were asked, Lissa told me before she left. I guess they were afraid of what our answers might be. So in the end, Mother had to let Lissa go. Had to fall back on leaking details to the press about phone calls that had never happened, trips home that had not been recorded due to Lissa's desire to remain off camera, and Mother's equally important desire to respect her daughter's wishes. But the truth is, when Lissa left this house, she never came back. Not once. Gretchen drones on about the possibility of a fictitious mission trip overseas once I begin to show, with footage limited to a few carefully edited interviews, angled to mask the baby bump. All the while, I would be hiding out poolside in St. John. The cook and housekeeper at the villa there had been heavily vetted before they were hired, and of course non-disclosure clauses were included in their contracts. They would never tell. I could give the baby up for adoption anonymously. Alternatively, Mother and Daddy could adopt the baby, if we wanted to keep it in the family. I could have a brand new brother or sister, and there would be the obvious and added benefit of their appearing to have come to the rescue of a child in need. Mother dismissed this idea before Gretchen had even launched into the particulars. There was too much of a chance that the child would look like a Hicks. Even a slight family resemblance might trigger exactly the sort of rumors they were trying to avoid. "What else are we left with?" Mother asked. "A wedding," Gretchen answered. "Essie could get married quickly. I could throw something together by the end of the month. We'll have to come up with a reason the ceremony can't be put off. A sick relative on his side or yours whose dying wish is to see the young lovebirds take their marriage vows." "What happens when the baby is born too soon?" Candy asked. "At least some of our viewers can do simple math." "I know a private midwife who will go on record that the due date is whatever we need it to be, then make a statement that the baby came early. Essie will deliver at home so we can limit the number of variables. But even if there are complications and she needs to go to the hospital, I've got contacts there as well. One obstetrician in particular that I know we can trust." I hold my breath at the sound of a chair creaking as Candy or Mother pushes back from the table. Gretchen would not dare to do this until formally dismissed. "Candy," says my mother. "I have to admit, there's something appealing about just having it over and done with. But remember what happened to Bill Lennox when his daughter got her abortion? It was just supposed to be a few pills she took at home to induce a miscarriage, but she ended up hemorrhaging. It was all over the news. His bid for the governorship was over before it even started." "I agree," says Mother. "It's just too much of a risk." "So, a wedding it is," Candy sighs with finality. "And just who do you think the lucky young man should be?" "Give me a day," Mother tells her. "I'll let you know by tomorrow." With this, I scramble down and toggle the dryer to resume its cycle. I slip out through the back hall and step into the sunroom. There's an empty watering can on a shelf beside Mother's large, overgrown jade, and I pick it up, tilt it over the pot. I face the windows overlooking the yard until I hear the door open behind me. Then I turn and smile at Gretchen, who quickly lowers her eyes and shuffles off toward the basement stairs that lead down to her office. After Gretchen comes Candy, who embraces me expansively and kisses both of my cheeks. She looks back at Mother, who tilts her head to the side in an act of dismissal, and makes for the basement stairs as well. Mother gazes at me appraisingly in a distant, slightly cold way. "How are you feeling?" she asks. I replace the empty watering can and stand awkwardly with my arms folded in front of me. "Fine, thanks," I tell her. "How was the library? Did you find the book you were looking for?" I nod and remind myself that the first lie, the one that started everything, was told this morning when I fabricated a school paper I had to do research for. Now I need to stay calm and see it through. I am breathing faster than I should be, and so I lower my arms to grip the edge of the shelf behind me and will my voice not to shake. I try to sound as casual as I can without raising suspicion. "While I've got you in private," I say, "I was wondering if I could ask you to add Mr. Richards and his family to your prayer list for this week." "Why?" she asks, her eyes narrowing. Typically, this is the type of thing we discuss freely in front of the cameras. Most people in town like to hear their name mentioned on the show for all the usual reasons. The birth of a child, the death of a distant cousin, the onslaught of some minor affliction that he or she needs the Lord's help to rise above. "No reason," I say and drop my eyes to the floor. "It was silly. Forget it." What is essential at this point is that I remain silent while Mother considers whether or not to take the bait. I grind one foot absently into the rust-colored floor tiles, twisting my heel back and forth. This is a habit of mine when I'm hiding something, which works particularly well in this case because I am hiding something, just not the something that Mother thinks. The best lie, Candy always says, is the one that is 99% truth. It's easier to sell. "I will not forget it," Mother says brusquely in a tone that is meant to be noble. "If the Richards family needs my prayers, then they will have them. I do, however, need to know what exactly I'm praying for." "Well," I say softly, "I heard that Mr. Richards might lose the store. He went to the bank for a loan, only his credit is so bad the bank wouldn't give him anything at all." Mother narrows her eyes, says, "And how did you come by this information?" I shrug, then tell Mother more of what is true. "Lily told me. It was her father who had to turn Mr. Richards down. Please don't say anything to Daddy or anyone. Even Lily wasn't supposed to know." Mother swallows and nods. "Mr. Richards always was a proud man. He wouldn't want anyone talking behind his back or knowing his business. Still, I'm glad that you told me. What they need now is the power of prayer, and that's just what they'll get." She tugs at the bottom of her fitted blue brocade jacket. "Yes, ma'am," I say. "I'm sure that will make a world of difference to the three of them." Mother moves toward the door and then turns back as if something has just occurred to her. "Rourke Richards is about your age, isn't he?" "He's one grade ahead," I answer. "I don't know him that well, but I've seen him at school." "He always seemed like such a polite boy," she says thoughtfully. "Yes, ma'am," I repeat. "That's what everybody says. Do you want me to bring some of your muffins to school on Monday to give to him?" Second only to her praying, Mother believes her muffins are the most surefire cure for all the ills in the entire world. "No, no," she shakes her head. "I think I'll bring some by the house instead." Mother leaves the room then with a clicking of heels upon tile, and I lean back, exhausted, and allow myself a ghost of the first real smile I've had in weeks. As she goes, I realize that she's forgotten my birthday. But I don't even care. Her sudden heartfelt interest in the Richards family is the best present I could get.
Rourke. Dad's still at the shop when I get back from baseball practice, but Mom is home. She's sitting at the kitchen table with that woman, the one from church who somehow got famous for acting holier than thou, which in and of itself is nothing special, but she does it on TV. It's been a long time since I've seen the lady, and even then it was only from a distance. All spring, I've been ditching church to coach JV, since practice starts right after the late service lets out, and there's no way I'm getting up for the early one. I could probably get home and still make it in time if I hustled. That's what the players all have to do. But I told Dad that I need to be there early to set up, and he didn't push. Baseball may not be his favorite sport, but it's the only one that's got any chance of helping pay for college. Dad appreciates that a strong recommendation from the coach could really help my prospects. Working with the younger kids is basically community service. That's the sort of shit that makes an applicant stand out. The guidance counselor told me that, though she didn't say it in quite those words. I walk into the kitchen and scan for cameras, but there aren't any. She's come alone. I wonder if maybe she left them because she didn't want there to be any witnesses. But as soon as I think it, I know it's crazy. Still, there's something off about the entire family, and it doesn't really have anything to do with them being on TV. Right now, for instance, Celia Hicks is creeping me out, and there's not a single television camera in sight. Maybe it's all the smiling they do. The plastered-on look of it, their mouths split wide open, teeth bared, like animals being led to slaughter. Not Celia Hicks, though. Never her. Her teeth are always covered. Mom would call that sort of smile ladylike, but I think she probably hides her teeth because she has the sharpest fangs of all. Before they notice me, I take the opportunity to really look at her. From where I stand, I can see the spot near her hairline where the makeup thins and gives way to normal skin. The sort of skin that is filled with pores, with imperfections. Her hair has dyed. I see that now. I'm not an expert on women's hairstyles, but for some reason I find it thrilling that just behind her ear, there is one fine wisp of gray. I stare at this rebellious strand of hair as if just by looking at it I might be able to spot her other flaws. She must have them. I know. No one could be that perfect. Mom looks up, startled. She's actually holding that woman's hands. Their fingers are intertwined across the table, and I can tell that Mom's been crying. Not Pastor Hicks's wife, though. I'll bet she never sheds a tear without capturing the moment to milk it for all it's worth.
You're home,
Mom says, entirely unnecessarily. I'm home, I repeat. Not because I'm being sullen, but because I'm still trying to get my bearings. To know what's the right thing to say. There's a tin of muffins on the table, clearly an offering from Celia Hicks, and I try to come up with some reason we deserve them. Typically, we fly below the radar. We sit in the back row or slip in right after the service has started. That is, if we're not skipping out entirely. We do belong to the church, of course. Everyone in town does. The folks from the surrounding towns as well. Even Lev Gottlieb, who everybody knows is Jewish, plays his trumpet at Easter every year. He's coming back from Juilliard specially next month. The way I heard it, his parents got into some sort of mess with the health department. They own a deli on the corner of Main and Pine, but once Lev agreed to play with the brass section during the Easter extravaganza, broadcast live, those troubles went away. Lev has been playing for them ever since.
Rourke,
Mrs. Hicks says warmly and pulls her hands away from Mom's. I'm embarrassed to see that Mom seems visibly crestfallen when Celia Hicks lets go.
It's so very nice to see you,
the woman continues.
Your mother has just been telling me about Columbia.
Congratulations. That's quite an accomplishment, young man. I look at my shoes and produce the expected response. Thank you, ma'am. I'm not sure it will work out for me to go, but I'm real grateful to have been given the chance. There's no way I'm going to Columbia. I don't need a financial aid letter to tell me that. Even with help, there's no universe in which we could afford it. Well, that's such a nice way of looking at it. Mrs. Hicks turns back to Mom. You've raised a fine boy, Suzanne. No doubt there. We think so, Mom answers. And then, when it seems that more is expected, she says, Essie is getting quite grown up herself. I saw her just last week when I was picking up Rourke after school. She's the spitting image of her daddy at that age. Mom went to high school with Pastor Hicks before he left town for college and then seminary. Celia Hicks, on the other hand, is an outsider. Though most everyone seems to have forgotten that, and for some reason she doesn't seem happy to be reminded that Mom knew her husband long before she herself met him. Her lips press into a thin, hard line. It lasts only a second, then the expression softens, and once again it's the face we all know from church, or else from television. The face that would have you believe that this woman is so pure, both inside and out, that her shit don't stink. She nods. The girls always did take after Jethro, and the boys take after me. Though people say that Caleb's eyes are the exact same shade of blue as his father's. Of the boys, only Caleb seems to be around with any regularity, having just finished law school. I've heard rumors that he's considering some sort of career in politics, which shouldn't be a problem with all the money the family has to throw into a campaign. Oh, I see that. I definitely do. Mom is agreeing with her, though I'm fairly certain that she's never seen Caleb Hicks's eyes up close. Both women stare at me for just a beat too long. Even with all the smiles and compliments, it's clear that I'm intruding. I cough and shift my bag onto my other shoulder. I'm still in my baseball uniform. I think I'll hop in the shower. It was a real pleasure to see you outside of church, Mrs. Hicks. They wait until I'm nearly all the way up the stairs before they start to talk again. And by that time, I'm too far away to hear anything they say. The next day, I see Essie Hicks everywhere I go. It's strange because I haven't really noticed her all year. We didn't go to the same elementary school, but I remember that when she was a freshman, it seemed as if every corridor I turned down had a film crew in it, just waiting to catch the perfect shot of her walking casually down the hall. Her hair was longer then, light brown, the same color as her freckles. She wore barrettes with flowers on them, or sometimes birds or ladybugs. It was like they were trying to make her look younger than she was, to preserve that innocence that made her so popular with the press. Or maybe she just liked ladybugs. I never got close enough to ask. Blake Preston got close, though. He's the only one of my friends who's actually talked to her directly. But not because he walked up and said hello like a normal person would. It's because he failed ninth grade math and ended up repeating it the year Essie started at Woodside. Blake sat behind her in class, and instead of paying attention to Mrs. Nixon, he would spend the entire period trying to tie pieces of Essie's long hair into knots without her noticing. It became a game. Every day, he kept track of how many knots he'd tied before she finally moved forward in her chair. Eventually, she turned around and told him to cut it out or else. And Blake did, he told me, because he could tell that she meant it, no matter how sweet she seems when she's on TV. The cameras don't follow her in school anymore, so I guess it's possible that I've passed Essie on the way to physics every day and just never noticed. But I don't think so. And I don't think she's been in the third floor hallway on any other day when my American government class lets out. But today, she's standing there, tugging at the ends of her shoulder-length hair, listening to Lily Gaines talking about how she's certain that she failed their Spanish quiz, and how if she gets anything less than an A, she'll never get into Vassar. It seems crazy to me that anyone would pay attention to such self-absorbed whining. But Essie manages to keep her eyes on Lily's flapping, berry-colored lips. Then, as I pass close by them, she glances over at me. And our eyes meet. And she gets this little wrinkle in the center of her forehead, like I'm a puzzle she's trying to solve. Just as I'm about to stop and ask what her problem is, her eyes move back to Lily and she says, "Vassar would be crazy not to take you. I 100% know that you're going to get in." Lily probably will get into Vassar next year. Not that I care one way or the other, but there is a building there named after her grandmother, and I know enough to know that this is how things work. It's amazing the things money will buy. Lily and I went on one date last year when I was a junior and she was a sophomore, so I know that her house is the sort of place you would call a mansion. Her dad has some high-up job at the bank. He may even be in charge. I didn't go inside the house, though, just caught a glimpse of the chandelier shining down on the polished white marble floors in the entryway. Still, I can pretty much imagine what the rest is like. High ceilings with soft, recessed lighting. Window treatments instead of curtains. A double-door fridge that's probably filled with nothing but tofu and vitamin water. It's the sort of house in those magazines that Mom likes to buy and then flip through and clip out pictures from. She puts these into a box labeled Inspiration. But as far as I know, they've never actually inspired her to do anything more than buy another magazine and add more pictures to the box. I took Lily to the movies, something with Theo James, and she talked about how hot he looked every second he was on screen. It kind of made it hard to concentrate, even for me. And I'm someone who can tune out an awful lot. Also, she ate almost the entire bag of popcorn, even though she said she didn't want any when we were at the concession stand. That sort of thing drives me insane. So, all in all, not a stellar evening. But then, when we got to her front door, there she was, standing with her eyes closed and her berry lips turned up toward me. It was impossible at that point for me to do anything other than kiss her. Not unless I wanted her complaining to all her girlfriends about what an awful time she'd had. So I did. For about 15 seconds. I know because I tapped out the seconds on my leg while my other hand brushed the curve of Lily's chin. The way I saw it, it had to be more than a peck. Or else I risked going through with the kiss and having it not count at all. Of still having her feel slighted. But it also couldn't be a full-blown makeout session, or else she might invite me to come inside, up to her room, that sort of thing. It would force my hand, make me tell her no. Or even if it was just front-step kissing, too much would mean I was a douche if I didn't ask her out again, which I honestly had no intention of doing. So, 15 seconds seemed about right. Interested, but still gentlemanly. Then, later that week, I told Blake and Sam Wells that I'd gotten back together with this girl I'd been seeing over the summer, hoping that it would get back to Lily and I would be off the hook. Strictly speaking, this girlfriend was a work of fiction. But it was a ploy that I made use of on and off until the end of junior year. It got somewhat harder to pull off after I got my license, and risked being dared to actually produce said girlfriend in the flesh. Before I could drive, all I had to do was invent little snippets of our conversations in order to be convincing. And if my parents didn't feel inclined to drive me all the way over to Bridgeton to see her, it wasn't really my fault that we hadn't gone all the way. After I bought Little Jimmy, a blue second or third-hand hatchback with a dent in the passenger side door, it became harder to lie. So for 3 months at the beginning of senior year, I dated Gemma Moore. Her mother was a member of the New Light Altar Guild, and the year before last, their family spent Thanksgiving with Pastor Hicks. Gemma was prettier than Lily and wore less makeup. She had a round face and hazel eyes and a mess of dark yellow curls that she pulled back with some rhinestone-studded clip I would knock loose any time I slipped my fingers up into her hair. I was surprised by how much kissing was involved with dating Gemma. Her plain clothes and long skirts had not really hinted that this sort of thing would be open for discussion, but shortly after Gemma's parents invited Mom and Dad and me to join them for Sunday dinner, Gemma started sneaking over after school to hang out before my parents got home. I never asked where her parents thought she was, but I knew it wasn't in my bed sighing gently as we listened to Florence and the Machine, and I tried to unhook her bra one-handed. For one fleeting moment, I wonder if Gemma has anything to do with the reason Esther Hicks was looking at me so strangely just a minute ago. I look back through the jumble of bodies pushing me along the hall, but Essie's back is turned. Lily is still talking. Then the two disappear around the corner, and there is an instant when I think that I might run back, grab her arm hard and shake her, and ask just what she's playing at. But of course I don't. If I did, I'd have to explain why I care about Esther Hicks at all, and I don't know what I'd say. Mom was in a tizzy last night when Celia Hicks finally climbed into her giant black SUV and backed out of our drive. At dinner, she must have said a dozen times how nice it was for Celia to stop by. It was the first time I'd ever heard Mom call Pastor Hicks's wife by her given name. Each time Mom said it, she lingered on the E a little longer, as if relishing her newfound alliance, until the name became practically indecipherable. Dad grunted something in response, seeming preoccupied, and generally just let Mom prattle on. It was only when she pressed him, "You'll come now, won't you?" that he looked up in a startled way, and Mom had to explain all over again that they had been invited to the Hicks' house for tea on Thursday. Dad frowned and actually looked over his shoulder to see if there was someone else that Mom might have been talking to instead of him. Then he swallowed his mouthful of hamburger and said, "I suppose there's no way out of it." And Mom was off talking again at lightning speed. So what I want to say to Essie is that she and her parents should just leave us the hell alone. Are you allowed to say hell to a preacher's daughter? Probably not, but I don't care. I'd tell her that Mom doesn't need Celia Hicks to come swooping into our kitchen in a fog of expensive perfume. Mom doesn't need her attention in order to feel worthy. Dad doesn't need to be forced into his only suit, which has gone shiny at the thighs and elbows, to sit stiffly in the Hicks's parlor on a sofa that I know from the show is overflowing with matching pillows and has lace doilies draped over its arms. It will only embarrass him to have to endure that tea with your parents, I would tell Esther. So they should just stuff their Christian charity and their attention where the sun don't shine. We don't want it. Except that apparently Mom does, desperately. After school, she does nothing but talk about the fact that they've been invited to tea at the rectory. She's in an absolute flutter about having nothing to wear. Dad's suit is already laid out with the matching shirt and tie, even though the tea isn't until tomorrow. She's shining Dad's shoes when I get home, and there's a smudge of shoe polish on one cheek where she must have wiped it. She looks thin, and suddenly very old, sitting there with the shoe in one hand and the brush in the other. And I'm overcome by how deeply I love her, despite everything. "You're here," she says brightly, and I realize that she is not just stating the obvious. She is truly surprised and grateful for my presence. I slouch against the doorframe as her wrist begins to swing back and forth again, bringing the brush lightly across the shoe leather. "I kind of feel like hot dogs tonight, if that's okay," I tell her. "How about I start the grill and take care of supper? It looks like you've got enough to do." She smiles at me with an expression that tells me I am all she has ever wanted in this world. I am all her hopes and dreams come true. The look paralyzes me for a heartbeat, and I feel panic rising up like acid in my throat at the knowledge that two simple words would forever wipe that look away. Then she drops her gaze to the shoe again and tells me not to forget the potato salad on the bottom shelf of the fridge. And I feel the panic fade. Outside, I throw the dogs on the grill and then move back into the kitchen and get to work setting the table. Without even thinking, I switch on the television to fill the quiet, something I do when I'm home by myself and the place feels too empty. Usually I change it right away to whatever college football game is on, but today I run outside to check the hot dogs before I get a chance to flip the channel. While I turn each dog carefully, I hear a commercial droning on about some skincare product that will make the years of crow's feet practically melt away. Then, when I come back inside, she is there as well, as she has been all day long. Esther Ann Hicks is staring at me from the television screen, with that same look she had earlier at school, and I think for a moment that she can actually see me, that she is looking out of the television and into my kitchen, where I stand wearing my mom's flowery apron and holding a barbecue fork raised in the air like a sword. This is ridiculous, of course. Esther Hicks cannot see me, I remind myself. I take a step forward and then another until I am standing right in front of the TV. Her eyes flick away from the camera and back to whoever is interviewing her. A banner in the bottom left corner of the screen tells me that this conversation is being broadcast live. She must have left school and gone right to the studio, or wherever it is that they're filming. For all I know, there's a special room in the Hicks mansion just for this. Maybe they change the backdrops and the furniture to give the illusion of variety, but make the journalists come to them. "This year has been a busy one for you, hasn't it, Essie?" the woman asks. She's young and vaguely familiar. Pretty, though it looks as if she's trying to hide that fact. Her hair is pulled back in a ponytail, and her collar is buttoned all the way up to her neck. Still, even in pants and the uptight blouse, you can tell that her body is smoking hot. Or so Blake would say. "It has, Libby. It certainly has," Essie answers. "But of course, very rewarding all the same." "And you are really planning to graduate this year? A year early?" Essie nods. This is news to me. "I'm hoping to have enough credits to do it. I've taken extra classes each of these past 3 years at Woodside, some through independent study, a few others online by correspondence. It'll be tight," she says. And here she smiles, a look that is utterly captivating even to me, and I usually don't go in for that sort of thing. "But I think I might be able to squeak through and leave high school behind in just a few months' time." "Well, you certainly sound driven. Your parents, I know, are very proud." Essie blushes and drops her eyes. Her lashes tremble and then she looks up again. "And what are you planning to do next year?" the woman asks when Essie remains quiet. "We haven't seen you going on any college trips yet." "Oh, no," Essie laughs. A tinkling sound, so unlike the cackles of the other girls at school. I wonder how I never noticed her laugh before. I must have heard it on TV, even from the next room, while Mom watched Six for Hicks or the entertainment news. That laugh is almost enough to make me trust her. But not quite. "College is not really in the cards for me right now," Essie is saying. "Next year, maybe. Or the year after that. Goodness knows I appreciate how important education is, especially for young women. But before that, I really feel that I want to do some good in this world.
That's why I'm planning a year-long mission to help raise literacy rates for children of color in inner-city schools. And there, just like that, she loses me.